From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of Broadway's great dancers, Gwen Verdon. She created the roles of Lola in Damn Yankees and Charity in Sweet Charity. Verdon's won 4 Tony Awards, and later this month, she'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the New Dramatists Playwrights Workshop. Also today, Gary Sinise, co-founder of the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. He also directed and starred in the recent film adaptation of Mice and Men, which has been released on video. And critic Ken Tucker has a review of Willie Nelson's new album, Across the Borderline. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Deputies to the self-declared Bosnian Serb parliament have been told by their leader, Radovan Karadzic, that there will be catastrophic consequences if they reject the Vance-Owen peace plan. The Serbs are under pressure to sign the agreement. Meanwhile, a team of UN observers headed for the eastern Bosnian enclave of Djepa has been denied access to the area. Richard Carruthers has more from Zagreb.
Dr. Karadzic said Serbs were under brutal pressures. We faced the total destruction of our forces, the arming of our enemies, and, he said, strikes at our most strategic targets. The Greek Prime Minister told the deputies they had 90% of what they want and implored them not to commit suicide. The man with the most influence, Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic, kept up the pressure. Don't sacrifice more lives, he said, when peace is at hand. But peace was far from the minds of the Serbs, who reportedly killed 2 women when they shelled Sarajevo today. And Bosnian radio says there's continued fighting in the Djepa area of eastern Bosnia. A UN observer team headed for the Muslim enclave was turned back by a Serb checkpoint. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The European Community's negotiator on the Bosnian issue warned NATO officials today that any peacekeeping force in Bosnia will have to be prepared to fight if necessary. Lord Owen said that the warring parties must know that the peacekeepers have the authority to fight to enforce a peace agreement. NATO chief Manfred Werner said today that officials are discussing the issue of a stronger mandate for the proposed NATO-led force in Bosnia. As it is now, UN peacekeepers in the former Yugoslavia can only defend themselves if they're attacked. The House has approved the so-called Motor Voter Bill, allowing Americans to register to vote when applying for or renewing a driver's license and at other government agencies. The vote was 259 to 164. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The bill approved today is the result of a compromise worked out between the House and Senate. It calls for states to provide voter registration at agencies that assist the disabled and distribute welfare checks, but not at unemployment compensation outlets, which Republicans feared would lead to a large number of new Democratic registrations. House Democratic leader Richard Gephardt argued in favor of the bill, saying it's difficult for many Americans to exercise their right to vote.
In order to enjoy this right, citizens must first gain admission to the voting system, and the ticket for admission is registration. Unfortunately, the price of admission in this country, in many ways, is intolerably high.
The Senate is also expected to approve the measure. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points today to close at 3,449. This is NPR News. The State Department said today that an American man who was reported missing last week in Kuwait is being held in an Iraqi prison. The Reuters news agency quoted a State Department official as saying that the man, Kenneth Beatty, has been seen in prison by Polish diplomats who represent U.S. interests in Iraq. The spokesman said Beatty was convicted of illegal entry into Iraq and sentenced to 8 years in prison. He said U.S. officials are working to obtain Beatty's release. This afternoon, FBI Director William Sessions toured the ruins of the Branch Davidian compound outside Waco, Texas. Sessions said he doesn't think that either he or the FBI has been made a scapegoat by the media or the American people. Wade Goodwin reports from Waco.
FBI Director Sessions toured what is left of the Branch Davidian compound and spoke with Texas Rangers Captain Burns about the ongoing investigation at the site. Later at a press conference, Sessions thanked the citizens of Waco for their hospitality. Responding to reporters' questions, Sessions says that unlike Reno, he did not get a call of support from the president after the fire, but remains content about the treatment the FBI received from the press and public.
Well, I don't feel like the FBI has been made a scapegoat at all. I think there are many people that are concerned that people did not come out of that compound alive, that we were not able to extract the children alive. People expected us somehow to work the miracle. And all I wish is that we did.
Sessions meets with Attorney General Reno later in the week, reportedly to discuss his future in the Clinton administration. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin from Waco.
The president's task force on health care reform is considering a proposal that would prohibit patients from suing their doctors for malpractice. The proposal, known as enterprise liability, would still allow patients to sue their health plans, but supporters say it would relieve doctors of $5.6 billion a year in malpractice insurance. Supporters say the system would also get doctors to stop ordering costly tests and procedures just to protect themselves from being sued. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of Broadway's greatest stars of the 50s and 60s, Gwen Verdon, will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award this month from New Dramatists, the Playwrights Workshop. Verdon is a four-time Tony Award winner, best known for originating the roles of Lola in Damn Yankees and Charity in Sweet Charity. She's the standard against which many Broadway dancers are measured. A 1959 Time magazine review of Redhead, the musical, described her like this: her articulate hands, toes, and torso are parts of speech. Her body as an erotic spoof spelling sex in quotes as she overtilts a wayward hip or dislocates an amorous shoulder. Verdon's best-known shows like Charity, Damn Yankees, Redhead, and Chicago were choreographed by the late Bob Fosse, who was also her husband for several years. Since retiring from the stage, Verdon has acted in films such as Cocoon and The Cotton Club, and on TV, most recently, in an episode of Homicide. Let's get started with one of her songs from Sweet Charity.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine. I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say is, wowee, look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup! I'd never believe it if my friends could see me now.
First, I want to say congratulations on the Lifetime Achievement Award from New Dramatists.
Thank you.
Now, I know that at the ceremony that Chita Rivera, Richard Adler, who co-wrote the songs for Damn Yankees, Cy Coleman, who wrote the music for Sweet Charity, Kander and Ebb, who wrote the songs for Chicago, they're just some of the people who will be participating in the tribute. Have you had many tributes like this before, and do you like them? Are they fun, or are they a little embarrassing?
I always feel like a fraud, believe it or not, because I've always had so much fun doing them, you know, doing the different shows, that suddenly, you know, everybody paying attention when I'm not doing anything is, well, it makes me feel guilty.
Since you're preparing for this tribute, I thought this would be a good opportunity to do a little retrospective of your life on Fresh Air. Let's start with your very early days. Your mother was a dancer and a dance teacher.
Yes.
So I imagine you grew up in an atmosphere where there was a lot of dance.
I thought everybody danced. I thought every mother and every daughter danced because she was also a performer, and I would go with her. I'm speaking of being 2 years old, and I just thought that all those women had children and that everybody danced.
Now, I read about you that you had rickets when you were very young. And,
yes.
And that damaged your legs.
Me and O.J. Simpson, yes. We both had rickets. You're born that way. I guess it's from some kind of malnutrition. But with corrective exercise, not surgery, which they wanted to do, and my mother wouldn't allow it, but the orthopedic surgeon explained to her that one muscle was too long on the outside of the leg, and the inner muscle on the leg. That one was too long, and the outside one was too short. So it would allow the knee joint to swing out, so my legs made an X. if you can picture that. Anyway, she decided to, through exercise, shorten the inner muscle and stretch the outside one.
And did that work?
It sure did, that and corrective boots. They never operated.
What did the corrective boots look like?
Oh, God. They were just dreadful. They were big, high-top brown things, and the heel was very crooked. It would make me walk on the outsides of my feet so that the inner muscle would stay short. I must say it worked, because within, oh, I would say 2 to 4 years, my legs looked straight, though I had to wear these shoes, corrective shoes, whenever I was home or in school.
I don't understand how you were able to dance with your knee, with your legs in such bad shape and having to wear these corrective boots all the time.
Oh, no, I didn't dance with them on. And I did all kinds of exercises. My mother kept saying, yes, you're doing ballet, but instead of my heels being together in a turned out position, I was always doing everything with my toes as much together as possible, which would keep stretching that outside muscle.
So you did almost corrective dance?
Oh, absolutely.
I guess I'm wondering if you were ever self-conscious when you started to dance on stage, since you grew up so self-conscious about your legs.
You know, I was so young when I began performing that I don't remember being self-conscious. I do remember in 1959, I think it was, again it was Redhead, and it was the first time I ever read reviews. And I never read reviews on any of the other shows. And in Redhead, they kept calling me a great beauty, an Arlene Dahl type, who is a great beauty. And I became very embarrassed, I did develop a stage fright.
After that review, you developed stage fright?
Yes.
Why did that review lead to stage fright? It's such a flattering review. Why did it lead to stage fright?
It's very flattering, but I've never thought, and I still don't, and I know it's the truth, I am not a great beauty. I feel like one on stage, but I certainly don't look like one.
But don't you think a lot of beauty on stage comes from projecting that feeling?
I agree. But somehow, I mean, I felt very good and very secure, strangely enough, when they said I looked like a red-haired Fanny Brice or a female Charlie Chaplin. And I mean, I'm honored to be compared to people like that, but I felt like an absolute fool being compared to Arlene Dahl. And I thought those critics must be sitting in the back row of the third balcony.
So that made you feel like a fraud?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you started getting stage fright, what were the symptoms and how did you deal with it?
I would shake. My mouth would go dry. And I was afraid to be on stage.
Who, would somebody have to talk you onto stage?
I'd get out there and then panic.
Well, you can't panic on stage, though.
Well, I did. They say you can't sneeze on stage, but I did.
What's a time when you actually panicked on stage?
It, again, was during Redhead. And I would be out there with the entire cast, and everyone would leave, and I would have to sing a song. And sometimes I would just walk off and get my aunt, with whom I had to play the next scene. And I just skipped the song. I couldn't sing it.
What would the director say when you did that?
He was my husband. He understood. He sent me to an excellent doctor, and I was fine. But then I was also given an article to read about Laurence Olivier, who also had stage fright and would turn his back. Everyone thought, what a unique way of playing, being an actor, to be able to turn your back on the audience and play a scene. So whenever I would get this feeling, because then by that time I'd be afraid of being afraid, and when that would happen, I would turn my back and sing the song.
Did people,
and it worked.
Did people in the audience assume that this was innovative stage direction?
Well, if it worked for Laurence Olivier, it was going to certainly have to work for me.
My guest is Gwen Verdon. This month she receives a Lifetime Achievement Award from New Dramatists. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is one of the great Broadway stars of the 50s and 60s, Gwen Verdon. This is Gwen Verdon in a show-stopping number from Damn Yankees.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind to have no regrets. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. I always get what I aim for, and your heart and soul is what I came for. Whatever Lola wants.
I think Damn Yankees was the first Broadway show that you worked on with Bob Fosse, who later became your husband.
True.
What was it like the first time you worked with him and danced to his choreography? What was different about his choreography and direction from what you had experienced before?
The first thing that I noticed was it was so amusing. I know it was sensuous. I know it was all of those things. But it was done with such a sense of humor, and also done with the innocence of a child. So you weren't acting sexy. It just came out that way. And I was amazed at the training, because I had excellent training in many disciplines of dance, and I was amazed at how disciplined and what was required with Bob's work.
What was required of you that you...
Ballet, tap, isolation, which I had learned from East Indian dancing, and I mean there was his humor. I had worked with Jack Cole, who always did very sensuous women. He did Gilda for that number, Gilda from the movie Gilda, for Rita Hayworth. I think he's probably more famous for that number. But it's not funny. And Bob would do the same kind of thing, not the same steps, but his point of view was the flip side of that. It was just making fun of being sexy, which comes out much more sexy.
Do you feel that you played Lola, the devilish seductress, as funny?
I played it as a child. Have you seen little girls all dressed up in their mother's clothes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, lipstick smeared all over their face. I did it like that.
When you said that there was isolation required for Bob Fosse's choreography, do you mean like just moving one shoulder or an elbow or just like one part of the body?
Yes. And it was extremely musical. That was up to Bob. I mean, the music was the groundwork, but he would catch every little thing. If you moved your little finger, there would be a ting on a triangle. So, and there was an economy to the movement. You didn't just sort of blast out and dance. It was isolation and discipline. That's the only thing I can think of.
Would he do the moves to show you what he wanted?
Yes, and they were hysterical. And I once said, I don't think I can do that in high heels. So Bob put on high heels and did it.
Oh, no.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
well, he believed me, but he had to find out for himself.
Well, could he do it in high heels?
Sure he could.
So then you were forced to do it.
Not forced. I thought, as soon as I could see how he did it in heels.
What was the trick?
It was not a trick. It was a certain step in Lola where you keep twisting, and I kept thinking the heels are, one heel is going to scrape by my other foot.
So what was the solution he came up with?
Just do it. And if you're turned in enough, you have to be very turned in, which worked just great for me because that's how I studied dance. That's how my mother taught me when I was 2.
Because of your muscle problems?
Yes.
You know, I can't walk in high heels. I can't imagine how anyone could really do tricky dance moves in them.
Well, the weight is distributed differently. You have to take it in your thighs. Some people take it in their knees, and then they always have problems.
You work with Bob Fosse on several musicals, New Girl in Town, Redhead, Chicago, Sweet Charity, as well as Damn Yankees. Were there particular things that he liked to use you for that he thought of as being Gwen Verdon moves, you know, that were just saved for you?
No, you know, because you can do the same movement on somebody else. And because they're built differently and have a different point of view, it does not look the same. And Bob was very good about, I guess, using what the person had. I don't know what I've got, but I know when Annie Rankin replaced me in the show, she has great legs and she can jump even in high heel shoes. I was never a jumper, even barefoot. And so Bob would use this extension that Annie had and the fact that she could leap like that. Great grand jeté. And so he would change the steps.
Once you and Bob Fosse were married, was it any harder or easier to work together?
No, because I never thought of him when we were working as my husband. In fact, Judy Garland came backstage one time and she said, "Oh, your husband's done a fabulous job." And I actually said, "Who?" I don't associate that at all.
Why was it easier to not think of him as your husband?
It was not that I just did not think of him. He wasn't my husband when we were working. He was the director. He was the choreographer.
There was a period after you married that you stopped performing. What was that period like for you? Did you miss performing a lot?
Not at all. No, and I stopped because I very definitely wanted a baby. Oh, boy, how I wanted a baby. And I got one. And I also knew that the first 3 years of a child's life is when they learn to learn. I mean, it is just so valuable that time. Now they call it bonding. I just call it learning. And I wanted to be a part of that. And I wanted it to be fun to learn. So I just wouldn't work. Actually, it was 2 years and 9 months. I would do television once in a while, but not a Broadway show.
So you went back to the stage for Sweet Charity?
Yes.
Were you glad to get back? Were you ready?
I loved that property. I really liked it. I liked the character. And she was so upbeat. And no matter how many times she'd get knocked down, she'd just pick herself up. And, you know, she'd never become bitter or depressed, sad for a while, possibly. But there are so many bitter people in the world. You see them on buses yelling at themselves. And Charity was never like that.
Was there a moment when you decided, this is it, I'm retiring from dance? Or from, you know?
Yes. The last performance of Chicago, which was in San Francisco in 1978.
But why did you decide after that last performance of Chicago that that was it?
because I was over 50 years old. I couldn't do it the way I wanted to do it. Everyone else thought I was doing it just fine, but not me. And as long as I had set such a standard for myself, I was not going to embarrass or disappoint myself. So I just don't do it in public.
Do you have any acting roles in the works that I should know about?
No, but I just did two, which I'm very proud of, because they finally have started thinking of me as a character actress. I've always thought of myself as being a character actress. I mean, I'm nothing like Charity or Essie Wimpo in Redhead. So those were all character parts. I never just played the cute little ingenue, not even in Can Can. Anyway, on the television show, which has already been on, called Key West, I played a nun. And in the television show called Homicide, I played a 90-year-old woman.
Do you like doing TV?
Yes.
Good. Well, I look forward to seeing more of you on TV.
Thank you.
And in movies. I thank you very much for talking with us, and I want to say congratulations again on the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Thank you so much.
Gwen Verdon receives her Lifetime Achievement Award from New Dramatists May 18th. I want to remind you that we have a special concert coming up this Friday with Arthur Alexander. We'll be broadcasting live from the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. Arthur Alexander is a soul singer and songwriter whose songs have been recorded by the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Otis Redding. He's just recorded his first album in 20 years called Lonely Just Like Me, and I want to play you something from it and invite you to tune in for our concert on Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Until I make it on my own, I'll cry, but I'll get by, and I'll forgive you, girl, by and by, and I'll forget you someday, if it's really gotta be this way. And go ahead, girl, and do it. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but if it's what you want, I'll live through it. I'll cry, but I'll get by. It's really gotta be this way. In my heart, there'll always be a place for you. In my heart, I will always believe we could have made.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, turning a church basement into a theater. We talk with Gary Sinise, one of the founders of the Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago. Some of his early cohorts included John Malkovich and Laurie Metcalf. Sinise also directed the recent film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, which is now out on video. And Critic Kentucky reviews Willie Nelson's new album, Across the Borderline. It features duets with Bonnie Raitt, Paul Simon, and Bob Dylan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton met today with returning American soldiers at the White House, and he held meetings about the possibility of sending other U.S. soldiers overseas. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president welcomed home Marines who had just finished a humanitarian mission in Somalia. He told them that their successful return reminds the country that other missions lie ahead. Then he met with Republican and Democratic congressional leaders about Bosnia. The Bosnian Serbs are considering a peace pact that the Muslims and Croats have already signed. The president is waiting to see if the Serbs sign and what their signature really means.
I think one of the things that we have to discuss is that we want an agreement in words and an agreement in fact. And that's what we've got to watch.
If the Serbs adhere to the peace plan, Mr. Clinton is expected to send U.S. troops to enforce the peace agreement. If the Serbs do not sign, he may decide to use airstrikes against Serbian positions. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Top U.N. officials said today that military observers trying to get to a besieged area of eastern Bosnia to check out reports of heavy fighting have been turned back by Serbian factions. The observers had been given high-level Serbian permission to travel, but they were stopped at checkpoints, and they will try again tomorrow. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has released details on an international court to deal with Bosnian war crimes. This tribunal would be set up in The Hague and have 11 full-time judges. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The tribunal would have the power to try a wide range of war crimes, from rape and torture to murder and deportation. While the court has the power to investigate and indict suspects, its power to extradite them from the former Yugoslavia is more problematic. Given that economic sanctions have already been imposed on Serbia, there are few coercive measures, short of military power, left in order to force Serb and Bosnian Serb authorities to hand over suspected war criminals. Few people expect the Security Council to use force in order to secure the extradition of suspects. The result is that for the moment, if adopted, the Secretary General's recommendations would simply be an inconvenience for war criminals wishing to travel outside of the country where they might face arrest. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In Moscow, Russian officials have committed troops to peacekeeping operations in Bosnia if a UN-sponsored peace plan is approved. At the same time, Russian officials did not immediately give their approval to support President Clinton's call for military strikes and fighting in Bosnia continues. Russian peacekeeping troops would be used in the northern part of Bosnia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 3 points to close at 3,449.10 on volume of more than 271 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. According to the Federal Reserve, there was some improvement in the nation's economy in April after a slowdown in March tied to the weather. In its so-called beige book, the Fed said, on the whole, there has been generally modest improvement in economic conditions in much of the country. After declining sales in March due in part to bad weather, officials say that shopper traffic and retail sales were up in April. Tennis player Monica Seles met with reporters today 5 days after she was attacked during a tennis match in Germany. Ansa Martinez reports.
Monica Seles sat in her chair at a press conference carefully, so as not to aggravate a knife wound to her left shoulder. A spectator attacked her at courtside in Germany last week, and she spoke about it today.
All I just felt was like, ooh, something in my back, and I automatically went forward because I know something went in. I saw, I don't know how big it was, or, you know, and then I just saw blood coming out, and I mean, And I turned back and I just saw the guy with a knife.
Salas says she won't play at the French Open later this month and may not play at Wimbledon. Salas called for more security at Grand Slam tournaments. The 19-year-old tennis pro says she's mentally strong and has no plans to retire. For National Public Radio, I'm Alfonso Martinez in Vail, Colorado.
Arab delegates to the Middle Eastern peace talks have decided to stay on in Washington for at least another week. A Syrian official says this step is being taken in order to give talks a chance to move forward. The State Department says this indicates that progress has been made in recent days. Israel and Syria are now involved in working out a key point of their current controversy, a joint statement that would outline what each side means by land for peace. After a break of 4 months, the ninth round of Middle Eastern peace talks resumed again in Washington 10 days ago. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Gary Sinise is best known as co-founder and director of the Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago. The company, which has become internationally known for its innovative productions, launched the careers of actors like John Malkovich, who worked with Sinise for years, and Laurie Metcalf, who now co-stars on Roseanne as Roseanne's sister. Sinise starred in and directed a Steppenwolf production of John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. It opened in Chicago and moved to Broadway, where it won a Tony Award for Best Play. Sinise received a Tony nomination for his role as Tom Joad. Last year, Gary Sinise made the leap into film with his adaptation of Steinbeck's Depression-era novel of Mice and Men. He directed the film and starred in the role of George, which was played by Burgess Meredith in the 1939 film adaptation. John Malkovich plays the hulking but mentally slow Lenny, who was played by Lon Chaney in 1939. Sinise's film has come out on video. Our interview was recorded last year when the movie was released theatrically. I asked Gary Sinise why he wanted to remake of Mice and Men.
I actually became very familiar with and friendly with Elaine Steinbeck, John's widow, during the development of The Grapes of Wrath. It was while we were on Broadway that I asked her if she would give me the rights to Mice and Men, because I knew that our run on Broadway was ending soon, and I was going to go back to Los Angeles, where I live, and try to make movies again. And I wanted to go back with a very specific project, and this was a story that I loved.
As someone who not only got your start on stage, but is, you know, internationally renowned for what you've achieved on stage, do you have something of an approach avoidance relationship with movies?
No, I want to do it. It's much easier to do theater. You know, you don't need a lot of money to do theater. That's one of the things my high school teacher always said, and that's why I started my own company, is if you want to act, just go find a space and do it and act. And it's very easy. You don't need any money to go find a basement somewhere and put some actors together and get a couple of chairs and, you know, do a play. That doesn't take any money. But to make a movie, you know, you've got to rent the camera equipment, the editing equipment. You've got to process the film. You've got to cut it together. You've got to put some music in there. That all costs money. Then you got to find something. Then you got to finish it and dub it and finish it all. You got to pay the actors, you got to pay the camera crew, you got to pay all those people, the costume designers and everybody. Then you got to find somebody with a screen, you know, that'll play that movie. And in theater, it doesn't take that. I wanted to immediately go to work as an actor and not come to Hollywood or go to New York and bang on somebody's door and hope that I could get a part. But we were an actor's company who wanted to go right to work and do difficult and challenging roles right from the beginning. It wasn't about making a living at that point. It was about making good theater and growing as actors. And I think on that whole history and that bed of nurturing really helped me. And now I feel like I'm starting a whole new phase. I'm able to kind of transfer from stage into film in a way that a lot of actors don't have that kind of background.
Well, you once described yourself as a troubled, mixed-up kid who turned around his life in high school in a production of West Side Story.
Oh. Where'd you read that?
Oh. It's an article. I couldn't tell you which one.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right? I mean,
I did say that. I must have said that because that is true. I was kind of a screwed-up rock and roller in high school, and then me and some rock and roll buddies of mine I played in a lot of bands, so I always did like performing. And me and some of the rock and roll guys from the band saw that they were performing West Side Story, and we thought it'd be fun to go jump around and be in a gang. So we went and tried out, and a bunch of us got in it, and all of a sudden I discovered this other thing that I really loved, and it was this teacher in high school that kind of brought that out of me and reinforced something that I guess was inside there, but I just didn't know it was there.
I know a lot of men always thought it was silly to have singing and dancing gang members. That didn't bother you?
At that time, no. I mean, there were girls in the play.
Oh, I see.
It was fun. They were all of a sudden dancing with girls, and girls were around, and it was a way to meet girls at that time, too, you know.
So you were a shark?
I was a shark.
So what did you do to be Puerto Rican?
Makeup.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of funny because this is, you know, it's the North Shore of Chicago. There aren't a lot of Puerto Ricans up in Highland Park. So, you know, we did the makeup, and, you know, I was Peppy. Peppy the Shark.
So did you get any featured songs? I mean, did you get featured lines within songs?
No, I had a couple lines, you know, like bottles or knives or guns or something. Chains.
What are you going to rumble with?
Yeah, yeah, right. Rumble. I don't know what I said, but it wasn't... it was very moving. I remember me. I was that was at a time in my life where we had just moved. We had moved around a lot, and moving as a high school kid, you know, when you're that age, you know, you're really rooted in your friends, and you're making acquaintances, and you're and when you move away from that, it's very difficult for a young person to like find a new group of friends. And so I was kind of very rebellious and not getting along well with my parents at that time. So I was having a lot of trouble in high school. I wasn't going to class, and I wasn't reading or studying or doing anything until I discovered the theater. And all of a sudden it made me want to go to school and just work in the scene shop and paint sets and hang out with these theater people that were very different from the kind of folks that I was hanging out with. And this teacher was somebody who really turned me around. You know, I can't say that I had one of those teachers that had enormous effect on me. And all of a sudden then I was, my parents were, you know, all of a sudden because of that, I started communicating with my parents in a way that we hadn't been communicating for a while. And they started coming to see the plays, and all of a sudden, the troubled kind of kid who was really looking for something, all of a sudden, his family, you know, his family life changed, and his, you know, schooling changed. I still graduated late because I was such a jerk in the early part of my high school that I didn't have enough credits. But still, I found something that really made me want to learn.
My guest is Gary Sinise. He directed and co-stars in a new film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Gary Sinise is my guest, co-founder of the Steppenwolf Theater Company. You were 18 when you co-founded Steppenwolf Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So were you still in high school then, or were you out?
I had just gotten out of high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I went immediately and found a church and just kept doing, you know, theater. We just asked this church if they would let us work in there at night and do theater, and they said yes. And I just kept on doing it.
Critics have used words like brave and daring to describe some of the performances in Steppenwolf Theater Company. When you directed shows, did you feel that you were really pushing people to the edge of their own capabilities? What does it mean to be brave and daring on stage?
Well, I think being stupid is part of it.
What do you mean by that?
Being kind of silly and stupid is part of it. I mean exactly that, being uninhibited enough to let anything come out and to attempt anything without restriction. And that's one of the things that, because we were isolated in this basement, And, you know, it was 20 miles north of Chicago, and there wasn't any other theater around there. It's not like we were in, you know, one of many groups in a theater community. We were isolated in this little basement in a suburb. And it was almost like we, you know, at a certain point, we didn't care who came or how they reacted. We were just doing it for ourselves. And so we were kind of rebellious and kind of idiotic, and we just, you know, there was the one time I can remember us trying to, you know, get some people into the seats and do something for the audience was a miserable failure. We thought, well, let's do a musical.
What'd you do?
We put our own musical together. It was called Mac Anything Goes Over the Rainbow. And it was a Harold Arlen, Cole Porter, and Kurt Vile songs. And it was kind of a hodgepodge of all their stuff. And we thought, well, let's make some money. Let's do a musical. You know, nobody's coming to see our axe-murdering plays and, you know, these bleak things that we were doing and, you know, dangerous things. Nobody's coming, so let's do a musical. Well, I mean, you can't just do a musical. You have to be able to sing or dance or something. So it was a horrible failure. And that was that. After that, we decided let's never again attempt to do something simply for the audience that we will think will make money or be commercial or bring in a crowd. But let's just stick to our guns and do what we want. So there were many times where people just didn't show up to the plays, and I can remember we didn't care. We'd just entertain each other that night. We'd go out and get some beer and put on a play. We'd just improvise for each other and kind of do these things all night. We called random nights. And we'd do a random night whenever we wouldn't get an audience. And that was quite often.
What if there was one person in the audience? Would you do the play or would you do the random night?
If there was one person in the audience, yes, we would do the play. We would ask, you know, I mean, whoever was an usher or selling tickets that night, we'd just have them go sit with that person so they wouldn't feel so bad if we'd do the show.
I think John Malkovich was the first person from Steppenwolf to break out into movies and to really become nationally known. Were you at all jealous when that started happening?
That was a difficult time for our entire theater company. I remember I was the artistic director of Steppenwolf. This was 1982. And I was the artistic director and also the director of the first play that we took to New York called True West by Sam Shepard. And at that time, we were. I was very much pushing to kind of open our, you know, scope and look for a new audience and build our audience into a more nationally based audience. So in 1982, I decided to take one of our shows, and it was True West, and John and I went and were in the show at the same time. And I remember. You know, both of us were on stage the whole time. He did get, you know, a lot of attention. The role was very flashy. He was very good in it. And there were times where it was difficult. I remember, and the producers of that particular play made it more difficult because they would do things to pit John and I against each other and make me feel like I was not as important. And that was difficult, seeing as it was me who put it together in the first place. But once John got all the press, they obviously were focusing more on him than myself. And there was one time I came in, you know, and John said, well, I finally got my second raise. And I said, what do you mean your second raise? When'd you get your first raise? I said, I didn't get any raise. And so I went to the producers and I said, well, what do you mean you've given John two raises? You know, you didn't give me, you know, that's not fair. We're both up there at the same time. You know, I'm the director of the play. I brought the show. We had this thing. I made it happen. I talked him into doing it. I said, well, I'm gonna give you 2 weeks' notice if you don't give me at least one raise. They said, go ahead.
Whoa. Wow, that must have really hurt.
That really hammered something home to me at that time. And John, at that time, was going out every night with Antonioni or somebody else, you know. And I was trying to get the producers to give me another raise, or just one raise, just to make me feel like they weren't going to say, screw you, and, you know, you're not important. And That part of it was difficult. I never had any problem with John getting any attention that he deserved because he's very good, and you know, this was certainly a role of kind of a lifetime, and he put his stamp on this role, and I'm glad, you know. But I did direct it, and I did make it happen, and the producers of that particular show kind of ignored that fact at a certain point, and that became difficult to deal with. But John and I are still very close. We have no problems, and you know, we get along obviously very well. So it didn't affect our relationship.
So when the producers,
I just learned something about the business at that point that I didn't know.
When the producers basically told you, if you don't like it, you're welcome to leave, did you leave?
No, because the bottom line was it was my show, and it wasn't their show, and my leaving was not good for my play. And John and I were up there together, and it was important that I stay for the show.
Gary Sinise, his film adaptation of Mice and Men is now out on video. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Bosnia?
Well, we'll be hearing from Silvia Pajoli, who's covering the meeting of the the Bosnian Serb Assembly. That's the group that's going to decide whether or not to endorse the Vance-Owen plan. We'll also be hearing about Secretary of State Warren Christopher's trip to Moscow and what kind of cooperation he's received from Boris Yeltsin, and about some of the questions remaining and how implementation of Vance-Owen might work. Also today, Richard Stoltzman, the classical clarinetist, his recording of American music, and also a remembrance of Irving Howe, the critic, essayist, historian, who died today in New York at the age of 72.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Just before Willie Nelson celebrated his big 6-0 last week, he'd released a new album, which rock critic Ken Tucker says should give Nelson a new lease on his professional life. Here's the title song from Across the Borderline.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. When it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson that you must learn. You could lose more than you'll ever find.
Before the release of this shockingly good album, Willie Nelson was just on the verge of turning into a sad pop culture joke, a 59-year-old hitless hippie who'd become more of an outlaw for his run-ins with the IRS than for any sort of daring country music. Across the Borderline changes all that.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of a civil war. I'm going to Graceland, Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland.
That jaunty Afro-Western swing version of Paul Simon's Graceland is only the beginning of Across the Borderline surprises. The album was produced by Don Was, who also oversaw the commercial rehabilitation of Bonnie Raitt with Nick of Time. Was hasn't modernized Nelson so much as he's showcased Willie's greatest strengths, the way he phrases words conversationally, like a honky-tonk Sinatra, his knack for turning sentimental cliches into heartfelt emotions, and his gift for deadpan comic wryness.
So she told you she found heaven in your eyes. I think it only fair to warn you that sometimes she lies, but it's your heart
I can't tell you what to do. She's not for you. She's not for you.
Across the Borderline is crammed with big-name cameos. Nelson does an achingly lovely duet with Bonnie Raitt, and there's an ethereal collaboration with Sinead O'Connor on the Peter Gabriel song Don't Give Up. There's even a good performance from Bob Dylan, who sings a duet on a song called Heartland. Willie's record company wants you to know that he and Dylan wrote that song via fax machine.
There's a home place under fire tonight in the heartland. And the bankers are taking my home and my land from me. There's a big gaping hole in my chest now where my heart was. And a hole in the sky where God used to be. There's a home place under fire tonight in the heartland. With a well where the water's so bitter nobody can drink. Ain't no way to get high and my mouth is so dry that I can't think. Don't they know that I'm dying? Why ain't nobody crying for me? My American dream fell apart at the seams. You tell me what it means. You tell me what it means.
Clearly, this album has been conceived to make a media splash. Nonetheless, Borderline avoids becoming an overloaded celebrity self-indulgence. If anything, it's Nelson's most personal work in ages, since no matter whose song he's covering or who he's warbling with, the songs cohere as a portrait of one tough, lonely, proud old guy. Overshadowed in recent years by young new country stars and Garth mania, Nelson has now topped them all by creating an album that cuts across the borderline of country into every precinct of pop. As creative refinancing on a nearly bankrupt career, he could have called this one Paid in Full.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Richard Parker. I'm Terry Gross.
Still is still moving to me. I swim like a fish in the sea all the time. But if that's what it takes to be free, I don't mind. Still is still moving to me. Still is still moving to me. And it's hard to explain how I feel. It won't go in words, but I know that it's real. I can be moving or I can be still, but still.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jason Alexander, who plays Jerry Seinfeld's neurotic friend, George, on the hit TV series Seinfeld. And ABC newsman Farrah Sawyer on Desert Storm, Nightline, and his news magazine, Day One. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.